All right, so this topic is huge, to say the least. Books could be written about this. So I'm just going to give a broad brush. With my wife's approval, she said keep it no more than 40 minutes. So that's what we're going to do. So when 40 minutes is up, it's over. You know, you guys can ask questions. I may not answer them. But you know, it's absolutely a huge topic. But I think in the broad brush, which means we're not going to get all our detailed questions answered probably, just to give you a sense of what this is and how people have thought about it. So, you know, we're going to start with the scientific method itself. That science is a way of knowing. Dr. Moore, a partner, wrote a book called Science as a Way of Knowing. Where are we writing this book?
Okay.
Yeah, on the internet. Straight to you, Tom. Science as a way of knowing. In other words, it's just a structured, logical approach to a problem. And that's what I tell my classes. It's that if you ever have wondered why a flashlight doesn't work, you have been a scientist. You know, we think of scientists as looking kind of like me with glasses and a beard and you know, all that stuff. That's just not true. Look in the mirror, there's a scientist. Why? Because we're using a structured, logical technique to solve a problem. That's really all it is. So, you know, if you have wondered, gee, why doesn't my flashlight work? Well, it could be the battery, or it could be the bulb. We'll put in a new bulb, you know, or we'll put in the new batteries, and if that works, then we've solved the problem. Now, something as very basic as that is science. So, in many books, you'll see something like, here's the scientific technique. The problem is, the books don't all agree, and the explanations are somewhat confusing, and every field of science has its own methodologies and its own kind of procedures, so we've got to put a whole bunch of caveats in there. But in general, you know, we're seeing and observing and asking a question, and we want to know the answer. So we use a structured approach to try to figure out the answer to this. So we come up with a question, and we come up with what's called a hypothesis. In other words, based on what we know about this, what is the likely answer? And then we proceed. If we're going to do an experiment, we could proceed to the experiment. We can do the experiment. We can find out the answer. And, you know, that might lead us to further hypotheses that then we have to do further experimentation. And oftentimes it brings up more questions than it answers. If anybody's done anything like this, you know that you're coming up with many, many questions. But the thrill for people that enjoy doing research is that, you know, you get to uncover something about the universe that no one has ever discovered before. It's kind of like walking in virgin territory. Wow, this is exciting for some people to really find out something that no one knew before. And that's the value of basic science. And of course, it has furthered a lot of what we do in the United States. We can think of going to the moon. We can think of cures for various diseases and all this. And, so it's this structured methodology. So we have an observation, we have a hypothesis, we make a prediction based on the hypothesis. We're going to run the experiment. It either comes out supporting our hypothesis or not supporting our hypothesis. Lots of times we're going to apply something called statistics. So what I tell my students, and I have them sometimes raise their hands, you know, how many people here think that that truth is relative? And surprisingly, a number of students always raise their hands. Quite a few students raise their hands. Well, truth is relative. Well, actually, it's not. It's not. There's no purpose in doing science if truth is relative. If your truth is different than my truth, and your truth is different than Susan's truth, there's no point in doing science. Why? Because we're going for an objective reality here. We're trying to find the answer. And there's no excitement to, you know, lifting the skirts of the universe and finding something new if there is no answer, if your reality is different than mine. So in other words, science is based on the idea that there is an objective, absolute reality out there. It's foolish to even try to experiment or do anything if it's completely relative. And what you see is different than what I see. Okay, so that we've got to just put to the side. This is foolish. You know, why even do science in that case? And it means nothing. So I'm not saying that in certain disciplines, for example, history or English, I'm not sure where our deacon is, but we might have some relativity in terms of how people see things and some various perspectives. But in science, that's really not what we're after. That's not it. We are after the truth, with a capital T. And so the truth is really the aim of science here. And it wouldn't have any utility if we weren't getting to the truth, right? Mm-hmm. We know it has utility. So it might support our prediction, and it might not in terms of the experimentation. That's not the only way we can do science. There's something called observational science. So in other words, it's a value just to go out and describe what's going on. So I spent a year, for example, at Hopkins Marine Station describing señorita fish and their behavior. You know? And no one really had done that before, so I spent hours doing this. But that's science fiction. You're just describing something. So it doesn't have to be an experiment. Experiments are what we normally think of as science, but we're uncovering something about nature and about the evidences that we find in the universe. So that's kind of the bedrock of science. And if you have any questions, just raise your hand. I'll try to answer them. This is what a lot of things are based on. Now, we have to have good data, right? And so, what is good data? And we spend a lot of time in class talking about where to find good data. And, you know, what makes data useful to us? So science itself is based on the truth. But in science, we can never be sure of the truth. So that's something that we also have to grasp. So we're only talking about confidence levels in science. So we never say we have proven something absolutely, and everyone else is wrong, as some people try to say today. You know, that, gee, this has already been well established, there's no room for skepticism, there's no room for anyone to question it. Excuse me, that's not how science works. How science works is we often question what's already been decided or what's out there. Why? Because it never pins it down absolutely. That's why we do statistics, is to say we have a 50% confidence level that this is true. We have a 90% confidence level that this is true. 95%, 99%. We're never 100%. Even on the laws, like the law of gravity, we're never 100% sure that somewhere in the universe that this is not different. Right? And so even with the laws that we think we know, we're never 100% in science. So this is a major misconception. One study doesn't prove anything, excuse me, it does not. And so how does our confidence rise in science? That's a question. One observation, even though it may be very, very important, doesn't prove anything. Okay, go ahead.
Isn't that one of the other rules? That it has to be repeatable.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, there was a study at Stanford University in the early 60s when they first did a kidney transplant. And so this was when they were working on it. They have to give the person who receives the transplant immunosuppressive drugs because it's a foreign tissue. It will be rejected if you put it into their body without immunosuppression. This was before they had the technology to see that there were microtumors in this kidney. They put it into this woman, and very shortly thereafter, she had cancer all throughout her body. And so they said, okay, this is an emergency. We've got to take the kidney back out. We'll take her off the immunosuppressive drugs. And when they did that, guess what? All of her cancer disappeared. All the tumors throughout her body went away.
Wow.
So this was a single case, but it doesn't prove anything, but it's highly suggestive that our immune system is very important for cancer, right? So anything that bolsters the immune system is a hypothesis we can have out of this, is going to help us with cancer. But that one observation doesn't prove it. Right. It could have just been coincidental that when we took her off the immunosuppressive drugs, she coincidentally got over her cancer, right? So in other words, it takes a lot more than just a single observation to nail something down. So how do we nail something down in a little more detail? Well, if you're going to do an experiment, let's say it's an experiment with an herbal remedy, we'll say. It could be an herbal remedy, it could be a drug, anything like that. The gold standard for humans, at least, is called a double-blind study. And so a double-blind study means that you've got maybe some kind of, we'll say it's an herbal remedy, you've got some kind of herbal remedy, and you've got something that looks just like the herbal remedy, but is not the herbal remedy. And then you tell the researchers that they're going to distribute this, but you don't let them know which one they're distributing. They don't know if they're distributing the real remedy or the remedy that's called the placebo. And the subjects do not understand which one they're getting either. And the reason that we do this is something called the placebo effect is very powerful. The placebo effect gets really strong. If I put on a white coat and have a stethoscope around my neck and so forth, and I come in and I tell you that these two pills in my hand are very powerful pain relievers, and I give them to Father Nicholas. Well, he's likely, even though he knows nothing about this, to experience significant pain relief, up to maybe even 50% of what oxycodone would do, okay? And the reason is, as we understand it today, is probably that we are creating these chemicals in our brain, but there's also effects in our immune system, there's all kinds of effects. So in other words, your belief has a big role in this. We've got to correct for that. So in other words, he doesn't know what he's getting. Is it the actual herbal remedy, or is it something else? And so not the subjects and not the people who are doling it out, because they might give slight little clues. Like they might say, yeah, you know, here you go. Try that. They might be giving little clues, but this way they don't know which one they're giving, and the people don't know what they're receiving. All right, so if we see some difference, like 50% of these people get better, and only 10% of these people get better, well, we're still not sure. We'd have to do some statistics. Why? Because it depends on how many people we have in the study. You know, are there 10 people in each group? Or are there 5,000 people in each group? You know, which one do you think is more robust? Where it's 5,000, right? You're probably getting closer to seeing the truth. And so just a little pilot study of 5 people in each group, that's probably not going to tell us anything. It might be suggestive, but it's probably not going to tell us anything, right? But if we run it again and we say 5,000 people in each group and we come up with something, and we have a 95% statistical confidence that that's something real out there, and we run it again and we do it with 10,000 people and it goes up to 99% confidence, I'm pretty doggone convinced personally that we're seeing something real there, right? So, you know, lots of studies have been done this way, and one of the recent ones, and nutrition is an area where we don't really understand things very well, just to be honest. Mm-hmm. But one of the things was like vitamins, you know, they ran a study with thousands and thousands of people, it was pretty robust, and they did not see any difference between the groups. So basically the recommendation is these days, you can take multiple vitamins, but they're high on protein, based on these large studies. Okay, so but a certain individual may benefit if they have a nutritional deficit or they have a particular disease or something. They might really benefit. Okay, but this is just in a large swath of society. You, as the average person, probably aren't going to benefit, and so on. So that's the idea, you know, behind science. And of course, my daughter, having type 1 diabetes, she's very interested in new discoveries and things that way. And we can't really deny that science has had a role to play helping people live healthier, longer lives and things like this. Lots of scientists are committed to the humanitarian ideal of helping their fellow man. We certainly can't integrate that. So this guy, Dr. Moore from Harvard, in his book, Science as a Way of Knowing, he tends to take kind of an anti-Christian perspective, however. And so we might ask why. Well, he talks about the beginnings of biological science and so forth, and he talks about Aristotle, who was a disciple of Plato, basically, who had some of the most penetrating observations of biology up to that time, and he talked about many different species. He compared species. He compared how birds formed in about 5 different species, made some conclusions about that. He talked about animals from the sea. He divided animals into 2 big groups, those with red blood and those without, which mostly correspond to vertebrates and invertebrates as we would understand it today. But, you know, he was very insightful. He kept careful notes. And some of his information seems pretty modern when we read it. Some of it was off base, but a lot of it was pretty modern. So that got handed down, the Aristotelian method of research into natural history and biology got passed down. Pliny the Elder in Rome developed an encyclopedia. A lot of it was based on Aristotle, but he had a lot of information in there, which was amazing. So in the ancient world, there was a tremendous amount of, for then, information. Of course, they only considered four elements, earth, air, fire, water, which from my students today, showing them the periodic table, gee, too bad we didn't live back then. We'd only have, you know, two kingdoms, the animal and the plant kingdom, and we've had four elements. You know, it's been so easy. They forgot about Pythagorean theorems and all that stuff. But anyway, yes, it would have been easier. But that really held sway. Some of the fathers of our church relied on some of this information in what they were writing. And later in the Middle Ages, it became things like bestiaries. They're written documents about different species. So, for example, for the lion, you know, they said that the lion only walks on the heights and looks all around. And when it has cubs, the cubs are dead for 3 days, but then they come back to life. You know, well, the reason they were doing this is because the lion represented Christ. And so they were making a connection with Christ. And some of the fathers did it with other species, like the stork was supposed to have, you know, poked its breast and fed the young from the blood that flowed from its breast, which we know is not true now, but it is a wonderful example of spiritual reality, you know. And those facts about the lion, supposedly, were also good in terms of the theology, in terms of what it says about God and so forth. Some of it wasn't quite right. But the reality behind it is true. So, science is a way of knowing. In other words, we're uncovering things about the universe, okay? But the danger with it is that we begin to forget God. Okay, so that's the flip side. So, if we forget God and we exclude God and we use the scientific method, we can go to what's called scientism. Scientism means that we reject anything sacred. And that we're now in the realm of anything goes for the human being, right? And so this is the objection that you come to, is that science becomes scientism. And did it do that in the West? Well, it would have been a long process, and I'm not really qualified to talk about it per se, but, you know, was there something in the West and Father Serafin's talks about the Orthodox worldview and things like that kind of bring that up. In other words, what happened in the West that made the West become very logical in the mental sense, intellectual sense, but not in the heart sense? And he talks about scholasticism as being one of the main watersheds where the West diverged from the East. And in other words, in scholasticism, we try to pin down in a very ordered, logical way, all the proofs for God, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin and all this, and exactly how things work, and the fact that the earth is the center of the universe, and man is you know, the center of creation, the crown of creation, which certainly has, you know, spiritual truth there. But this became a whole system. And Thomas Aquinas, the scholastics, etc., promoted this system, which is not surprising because the Romans in the west part of the empire were really juridical. And they insisted on basically jurisprudence, logic, and things like that. In the east, it's much more mystical, and allegory and those types of interpretations tend to be more common. So when the two churches split in 1054, they didn't balance each other anymore, is what Father Serafin would say. And so the West kind of went off on their own tangent and began to be much more intellectually oriented and therefore missed out on the whole body of mystical and ascetic literature that was available in the East. So they began to go off into scholasticism and try to nail everything down intellectually. But you can even see it in the art, where the icons began to be signed by people, and people began to take credit for these things, where in the end, we get to, in the middle of the 1500s, to Copernicus, who basically said, you know, my measurements don't quite show that the Earth is the center of the universe here. You know, which he knew was bad. He knew that was bad, and he wrote a letter to the Pope, you know, saying, I know this is bad, Your Holiness, but here's kind of my evidence. It doesn't sound good. You know, he got off the hook. You know. But Galileo, following up about 50 years later, he didn't get off the hook, unfortunately. So this is something that Dr. Moore brings up in his book. This has a huge chapter, you know, about Galileo and his defense of the fact that the Earth is not the center of the universe, that actually the Earth goes around the sun and so forth. And he did get condemned to arrest for this and was under the Inquisition's microscope and basically died under house arrest. And, you know, that is a sad chapter. So, you know, then later, people felt freer in the West to explore these things and so forth and so on. I think we could make some analogy between Protestantism in the West and the fact that there was no Protestant revolution in the East. The fact that, really, there was no need for a scientific revolution per se in the East because there wasn't that kind of suppression of intellectual pursuit and scientific understanding. So in other words, in Constantinople, they made a cement that is actually superior to anything we make today, you know, and things like that. They had a lot of the knowledge of the Greeks still available. They could read all those texts. They weren't like a revelation to people in the 1500s, but gee, look at all this Greek wisdom. They had it. And so I think because we have such a Western Roman perspective in terms of how we learn these things in our history, it skews our understanding of this dichotomy between science and theology. So in the West, of course, everything starts to take off from that point, from the 1600s. People delve into medicine, and they delve into all the astronomy and other sciences. And in biology, of course, you have von Leeuwenhoek, and you have Hooke, and other people that are looking through microscopes. They begin to see cells. Cells are considered then, in the cell theory, to make up multicellular organisms. And then you've got a monk, who actually is Mendel, who comes up with genetics. No one knew how heredity was passed on. He was working in a monastery in what is now the Czech Republic, came up with peas as his study, you know, so he could grow food for the monastery, and at the same time, he also had a background in natural science, and he was a mathematician. So he was able to apply these statistical methods, and actually he called them factors, but we now know they're genes. And he came up with exactly the right answer in about 1860, you know, before anyone had an idea of what he was talking about. So his study got shelved for about 40 years until microscope technology got to the point where people could see the chromosomes and people could see what was going on inside the cells. And then they said, gee, I wonder if what he was talking about was on these chromosomes. Sure enough, it was. And then people like Morgan, New York City, started to work on fruit flies. That's why fruit flies are known as the genetic organism up until today. And he was trying to do something like find mutants, you know, find evolution in fruit flies, which he was not finding, interestingly. Fruit flies did not seem to mutate much. You could do all kinds of things to them and not get a new species out of it. But he did find a white-eyed fruit fly, and all of them tended to be males, which was really strange. So his it's about 100 years ago now. But they found out that this was on the X chromosome, sex-linked trait, and so on and so forth. So, you know, all of genetics began to be revealed. A lot of embryology and developmental biology began to be explored. And, of course, Darwin. He came up with this idea of, you know, descent by modification, natural selection, and we've probably all heard of that. And Darwin himself was very conflicted about this, threw up a lot because he was so stressed out that he knew this was, you know, it's very strange and didn't quite jive with the church. And a lot of the natural historians were clergy in the late 1800s. These were the people that had a little extra time to delve into these things, and they often did, and they had the education. So he shipped on to the Beagle and went around the world and, you know, saw lots of different things in the Galapagos Islands, most famously. But, you know, his idea was certainly that one species could become another species, could become another species, and so forth. Well, that really wasn't shown by Morgan. He tried to look for something evolutionarily with fruit flies. With plants, it was a little bit easier. De Vries with plants found that you could generate a whole new species just pretty much instantly with polyploidy. But anyway, he was trying to do it with animals, a lot harder to do. So that became a bit of a roadblock, but of course things again progressed. We now have understandings of DNA, the whole human genome, and now we're working on the epigenome as well as the proteome, which is what all of the proteins do in the cells. And putting that all together is going to take another few hundred years probably to really understand it all with even the supercomputers. So there is a lot going on. I think we're in a golden age of biology. There's no single person that can understand everything about biology. There's not even a chance that there are so many specialties, so much going on. Probably there was some biologists around 1955 that probably could tell you everything there is to know about biology. There's not even a chance there's a person like that today. So, you know, just the field has increased so immensely. But we also have some warnings from some of the prophets and elders of our church that in the last days there will be depraved wisdom. In other words, we'll have wisdom, but we won't be using it ethically or morally or understanding it correctly. And so that's kind of a big warning, you know, that in the last days you will be able to talk from the one end of the world to the other, be able to dive to the bottom of the sea, go up into the sky like a bird. Well, that all sounds familiar. But it wasn't attached to something necessarily positive. It was attached to a warning that said, you know, this is depraved wisdom. So, you know, science is a two-edged sword. It certainly is useful. Studying things with a structured technique shows us a lot. We can understand a lot of different things. But are we using it correctly? In other words, ethics has to come into play, morality, and what we might say our conscience has to play a role.
Where does it say in Scripture some of those?
It's not Scripture. This would be... this was a saint of the 1500s, I believe. I can find the exact quote.
Not Nostradamus.
No. Nostradamus was the exact opposite, saying that in the end, humans are going to attain to the stars and that science is going to rule everything. So he's the opposite. Mm-hmm. I've got some notes on here somewhere. There we go. So, Colossians 2:8. It's true that we cannot properly understand the full significance of what we read because of the darkness induced by the passions. Our presumption often leads us astray, especially when we rely on the wisdom of this world, which we think we possess, and do not realize that we need knowledge based on experience to understand these things, and that if we wish to attain the knowledge of God, mere reading and listening is not enough. So in other words, go ahead.
A friend of mine who's an environmental scientist at the University of Portland said, and it'd just be interesting to know, you would agree with this. He says, science provides us with this map, this marvelous map. Mm-hmm. He says, but it doesn't provide us with that compass.
That's right. I would agree. And I think that's a very good analogy. So in other words, it allows us to go somewhere, and certainly we cannot deny that. That it's a powerful tool. But where we go is... You know, could it take us to very frightening places? And of course, with the hydrogen bomb and things like that, we have to say it certainly can. Can it take us good places? Yes. But where do we go depends on where we're going. depends on us, and it depends on how we direct these things and what we want to have happen. And so there's lots of people suggesting these days, for example, some at Princeton University and other places, that we might add a new gene to people, right? That we can actually, not just a new gene, but maybe a whole new chromosome. We can have a new chromosome with maybe thousands of genes, and people would no longer have 46 chromosomes, they might have 48. And on that extra chromosome, all kinds of extra abilities. You can see in the infrared. Maybe in ranges that you can't hear, all kinds of special abilities.
Something.
You talk calling.
Sorry.
So, you know, that would create actually a new species of human. And combine that with the idea that you can have all kinds of implants now with maybe you can scan the web with your brain and so forth. And, you know, we're going to end up with two kinds of people, right? We'll have those that have those and those that don't, and so on. And but there are people seriously advocating this stuff at this point. I don't know if you saw in the news, they just took a rabbit brain, basically fixed it, froze it, and then brought it back. And so, you know, there's people thinking instead of Christian immortality, material immortality. Okay, so this is like an opposite of what we know to be true. So St. Anthony the Great also has a warning like this because some philosophers came to challenge him. And we heard about this several weeks ago, right? And they came to debate with him. And he said to them, well, which is greater? What's written in the books or the wisdom that inspired the reading of, or the writing of those books. So, in other words, it's the wisdom that inspired the writing of the books that's greater than the books. And the philosophers were wanting to debate with him on this book level of learning and so forth, and they had to leave in shame, because that's just not how it works. So even though the fathers of the church used the science of their day to kind of explain how things work spiritually, that's really not the whole picture, right? And so we have this book of Genesis, and I guess we have to talk about it a little bit, that, you know, Genesis gives us a background about humanity, where we are, where we come from, where all of creation comes from, and so forth. And the Holy Fathers have affirmed the absolute power of God to do anything he wants, okay? So for us to try to limit God is actually foolishness. We can't do that. God can create everything out of nothing. He has. But for many centuries, and the Greeks were part of this, you know, it was assumed that things had existed from the beginning and that there really wasn't a beginning to the universe. And actually, as late as the 50s, Hoyle, who was an astronomer, also held that view and denigrated Christians because of that. Now we know all of a sudden that, wait a second, Christians were right all along. Everything came out of nothing. And what do we call it? Well, the Big Bang, right? That, you know, the whole universe inflated from something smaller than a proton.
We can also call it, and God spoke.
And God spoke, yes. And so, you know, to rely on the science of our time is a little bit dangerous that way. You know, we had to affirm, as Christians, the fact that God created everything out of nothing. And even in the face of the Greeks and of physicists and astronomers up until the 1950s, Christians had to say, wait a second, we don't believe that. And now it seems we're right. You know? But of course, there's scientists have jumped ahead. Well, there's, you know, multiverses, and there's all kinds of universes that we don't know about and all this stuff. But, you know, hey, they can't stand it. The Christians were right all along here. So that's, I think, a potent feature here. We got to keep this in mind. Yeah?
You have the Christians understanding the real science, the science behind science, the capital T of the truth.
That's right.
And science finally catching up to it.
In that case.
In many cases.
Yes.
And now I think that we're going to be confronted in our lives with, well, the Christians understand the scientific
things that show why things orbit and that God created all of these things. Why are you having such a problem with those doctors from Princeton implanting another chromosome in your head? That's just science.
That's right.
And that's like, no, 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 no.
That's right. So that's why we need to have an answer for this, right? And so in other words, I don't think that we've thought about these things as much as we should, probably.
Okay.
No.
You have to have an answer.
Right. So I've got to mention C.S. Lewis because I know that Deacon John wouldn't want me to. You know, that there is a connection, right, in his view, between science and magic. And there was just a book written, which I'm not sure you've read, called The Magician's Twin. The Magician's Twin. And it looks really good. It was written in 2013. But it talks about C.S. Lewis and his whole idea that science and magic are together. And why would we say this? Because magic purports to control reality and also can be a religion. Well, science purports to control reality, which it can. You know, it's more powerful than magic. And can be a religion. How can it be a religion if it really doesn't assume anything is 100% knowable and we only have levels of confidence? How can it be a religion?
I'd like to interject. My high school's biology teacher started out teaching us about the scientific method, and they said, well, you never, ever, you know, put God in your hypothesis. Like, mm-hmm. You know, well, in science, we don't
That's right.
assume there's...
Yes.
But, of course, there's a reason for that, which is that
right.
God is not just a natural law.
That's right.
And so you can't do experiments to
That's
prove
right.
your hypothesis.
Yes.
It doesn't... But people sometimes...
You're right.
...jump to the wrong conclusion and think
well,
that...
Well, okay. I think you've hit it on the head. Yes. And so, basically, in science, and starting with Francis Bacon back when, you took any supernatural influence out of science and assumed everything is controlled by natural forces. So, therefore, you wouldn't have God in your hypothesis because you can't swirl a test tube and prove that God is there. Though, we can talk about some angles of that. But anyway, you can't swirl a test tube and prove that God is there. You can't make God, our omnipotent creator, do what you want him to do and so forth. So you got to take God out and do your experiment. So, for example, in the herbal remedy experiment we were talking about, we're not going to assume that, you know, miraculous healing is part of it. Otherwise, you know, that throws our results off. So we're not going to do that. All right? So, yeah, that's a big part of it. And so that's one of the tenets of science, is we're going to assume that it's naturally based. But that feeds right into why it can become a religion, because one of the tenets of science is we eliminate God. One of the tenets of the religion of scientism is that there is no God. So this is, now we can start to understand why that's the dangerous part, and why C.S. Lewis talks about that. So there are these problems with science, that science has been co-opted by atheistic materialism, which, in fact, is a metaphysical view of its own, isn't it? So in other words, stating that there is no God, stating that everything is just physics and chemistry and biology, means that, metaphysically, you're making a statement. You're making a statement that, supernaturally, there is no creator, there is no reality to spiritual things. There are no angels and demons, there is no devil. And therefore, you do what you want to do. And that plays into, actually, the satanic creed, my will be done. That is the satanic creed. And actually, hang on, I've overheard some chilling things from students over the past 10 years. And my first encounter was when a student was walking down the stairs and I was following them, and they were a biology student. I was too far away to say anything. But they were saying, you know, I don't know why we let all these elderly people just hang around. And I thought, wow.
They never had a grandma.
I was thinking, wow, I've never heard anyone say that before. That's shocking. The second time was far back in a lab. I was teaching a lab, and I told Deacon John about this. I overheard a student saying, oh, you know, people misunderstand Satanism. Satanism is just where you can be who you really are. And she was explaining to some other students. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I have never heard anything like this. And this was like 2 years ago. But this was one of C.S. Lewis's main concerns, is that scientism leads into all kinds of unhealthy spirituality because we are spiritual beings. We are spiritual beings. This is the capital T truth. Science used rightly is trying to get to that same capital T truth. Used wrongly, it becomes scientism and leads to unhealthy spiritual conduct. And so its ability to function as a religion is something that we should not let them, whoever them is, pull over our eyes and pretend that that's not true. So I would say that's very important as a priest. I'm going to say this is dangerous. That you're going to say that your ability to know things by the scientific method gives you a metaphysical authority or understanding to declare that you know better than I do about these things, and yet we find that all the time.
But that's what Satan said in the garden. He said, God said, if you eat from this tree, you'll die. No, you won't die.
Sure.
God is a liar. You're not going to die. But if what he didn't want you to know is that if you eat from this tree, you will be like gods.
Right.
And that is just what people want. I want to be my own God.
That's right. And so that's the dangerous part, is that people do want to be their own God. The old man wants to call the shots. And scientism is just a ticket. And so this is the danger of it. The other danger that Lewis saw is that is the encouragement of a lack of skepticism. In other words, if somebody with a white coat comes in and says, this is how it is scientifically, we as a culture are trained to say, well, then I guess that's how it is. Gee, I guess that's it. But he argues that that is the root of how cultures become tyrannical. Government in the name of science is how tyranny comes into being, says Lewis. And he fought in World War I, got wounded. He saw World War II, lived through it, and the Nazis were claiming. We are doing things in the name of science and eugenics and everything. You know, we're going to have a master race. We're going to create a utopia. And you're either with us or against us. You know, and this is how it happens. He saw it in Russia, where communist Russians called themselves scientific materialists, right? And that everything in their society was supposedly based on science. We know that's a bunch of something, but that's what they claim, right? And so this is a danger to us if we just say, okay, we have to do these things. We have to give up our liberties. We have to believe what the scientists tell us. We have to believe this or that. We're going to lose our liberty. We're going to lose our country. We're going to lose everything, okay? And so this is his warning. The quest for power is the third thing that matches magic and science. You have magic, you've got power. If you have science, you have power. And so, in that hideous strength, he talks about NICE, which actually is the government agency responsible for establishing this control over the population. And it's called the National Institute of Coordinated Experimentation, or NICE for short. And so, it's given a sugar-coated appearance, but it's a poison pill. And if you take it, you're going to regret it. All right, so again, I am not anti-science myself. I believe in the scientific method. I believe in a healthy skepticism as well. And I believe in debate amongst people that have something to say, which I believe just about everyone has something that they can contribute. But that's really not what we hear more and more. It's like, hey, if you disagree, you're stupid. You have nothing to say. The debate is over. You're a denier. Out with you. That's not how science works. I'm sorry. But that's how our society is trending. And so, this is what we have to look at. So, Lewis was a firm believer that nothing is wrong with skepticism and open debate and freedom. And I have to say the same thing. Absolutely nothing wrong with it. And we should. Okay. And I think the Holy Fathers would say the same thing. He also said that a lot of what passes for science is really based on the paradigm of the age. So he said, you know, it's really not too surprising that Darwin came up with all of this stuff. It was already there. It was already in the air. And it just took somebody to catalyze it. And most scientific new paradigm shifts are like that. That it's already in the air. It's something people kind of want to accept. And somebody's just got to catalyze the change in thought. So that's interesting. But we have to direct these things. In other words, what is worth doing? What is actually the direction that we should take as a society? Science is a powerful tool, no doubt. But where we go with it should be our decision, right? And for example, GMOs are an example of that. You know, should we plant them all over the place? Should we have plants that are resistant to Agent Orange, which is basically what they've already got in the works right now, where we're going to be spraying fields with Agent Orange and having our crops come up? Is that the kind of future we want? Or do we want a different kind of future? And so I think that as citizens and as Orthodox Christians, this is the kind of thing we should be asking, you know, instead of being told that you're stupid, you don't know what you're talking about, and be quiet and go with the program. This is actually not what I thought I was going to talk about. So, you know, what counters this? And what counters it is the idea that God is the creator, right? God is in charge. And we know that the Logos, with a capital L, means the organizing principle in creation, as well as being the second person of the Trinity. Yes?
When people start modifying their brains and things like that,
which, yep.
Like, that's a really humbling place to be with an ordinary human brain in a society of people, you know, these modified brains, you know. How would a group of people be anything but slaves?
Yeah.
In that kind of society.
Right.
Like normal brain.
Well, sure. And if you're giggle, garbage in, garbage out. Mm-hmm. If you're given filtered versions of reality, what kind of conclusions can you make? Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's why freedom of information is important. Yeah.
I want to hear you talk about this a little bit. I would operate on the premise that God created science, mm-hmm. and therefore you're not going to find anything in science that is going to essentially disagree with God,
yeah.
because it's creator.
Right.
However, Father Tom Hoxha would say that there's a problem there because sciences are measuring a fallen creation.
Right.
So God didn't create sickness and things like that,
mm-hmm.
Or certain genetic structures that exist today that would be called reality,
mm-hmm.
and they are in a fallen world, but they're not in God's created world,
right.
ultimately.
So, right. Well, and that is part of what I wanted to talk about. For example, if you look at the creation account in Genesis, you will find that plants, all green plants, photosynthetic organisms, were created on the third day, and the sun was created on the fourth day. So how could that be? Well, apparently God, and in his light, is the energy for these plants. And then we might say, well, that's interesting, you know. But what is the nature of paradise? And I've talked about this with Tom and Nicholas before. But what is the nature of paradise? And, you know, we might say, well, paradise was here on earth. You know, there was a tree that St. Gregory the Theologian said that tree was actually contemplation. But, you know, there was a tree somewhere and so on and so forth. However, there are many stories of saints. And we had one last week, I believe, St. Dorothea. And she was a martyr, and one of the Roman who was actually in the government was taunting her and saying, you know, if you're right, bring me back some of the apples from paradise and I'll believe you. Remember that? And so she actually prayed. An angel of God came and gave him apples from paradise. He became a Christian. But we also have Saint Euphrosinus right over there, who was walking in paradise, right? And the abbot of the monastery, is this right, Father Chapman? The abbot of the monastery also was dreaming that he was in paradise and saw him there in brightness, in just gleaming garments, and woke up the next morning and said, where were you last night? And he said, well, where were you, my friend? And he found some apples from paradise in his cell, too. And so, you know, if paradise isn't here, where is it? If it's not right here, where is it? And is it in a level of reality that gets its energy from God directly? Is it still unfallen? Is it right above us or right around us? And, you know, this is interesting. I don't claim to understand this. Father Nicholas understands it. You can talk to him later. But I don't know.
No one understands.
But these are some of the questions that I have, you know, that yes, there's this unfallen reality. And I got to say that when I was up in Alaska, you know, they say on Kodiak Island, Father knows this, that, you know, you're not at the end of the world, but you can see it from here. Well, when I was doing this hike, you know, way back when, we got to this place that was way out on this trail. It was probably like 7 miles out or something. And honestly, it felt like paradise. It felt like just, you know, this was a piece of creation that was unfallen or something. I don't know how to describe it, but it was just remarkable. It was really incredible. And so I think that even on earth, we can touch into this reality. We can touch into it in the altar as we partake of the body and blood of Christ. But there's a reality to this. And so there's this unfallen, paradisical world. And this is real and this is true.
I think when you're around people who are dying,
Right, which is, I just want to make my last point. I don't know how we're doing on time. But
it's past 40 minutes.
Yeah, it's almost 40 minutes.
We won't talk.
Almost 40 minutes. But this is my last point, is that how do we know that there's something beyond scientism? And I want to just make this point. How do we know it? And we
beyond
know it
scientism?
Because, yeah, something beyond scientism and material reality. Because we are given the beauties of creation, right? We can see everything around us is intricately woven together, and that it is manifesting the unseen attributes of God. That everything around us speaks of Him. Now, whether we want to call that intelligent design or the anthropic principle or whatever, it all speaks that, you know, we actually are the center of creation. We actually are important to God. We actually are upheld by God all the time. And that's what the saints would affirm, that there's nothing that happens that isn't upheld by God all the time. The second thing is our conscience. And the fact that we know there's right and wrong. And this was, again, one thing that Lewis also, and many others, have had as an objection against evolution, is that, well, if evolution has brought us to the point of this consciousness, then we can't trust the consciousness. Because it's only an evolutionary product. And therefore, it is designed for a specific adaptation in a particular environment and really has no relation to anything real. So we can't rely on it. But, and same thing for our moral judgments. Therefore, you cannot say something is good and another thing is bad. But conversely, the scientist or the scientistic person cannot say this is good and this is morally right and this is bad and morally wrong. As a matter of fact, they should acknowledge that there is no way to say that. Something may have served the group and furthered that population. Something may have furthered an individual and their genetic makeup and so forth, but one is not right and the other is not wrong. So in other words, you got to take, if you're going to free yourself, you got to take the whole pill here. You got to say that you have no moral judgment either. Of course. There are, but then they have nothing to say. Because if they try to say, well, morally, we should do this, you say, what more? What morality? What are you talking about? Morality is God-given. But, you know, we shouldn't be surprised because St. Paul came up with these exact two things in the first two chapters of Romans, where he came up at the end of chapter 1 saying that the whole creation shows forth the invisible attributes of God, and therefore we're without excuse. That the whole creation is fitly joined together and that it's beautiful. And in the beginning of chapter 2, he says, even the pagans have that do good have written in their hearts that law. And that if they do good, then their own conscience either excuses or refuses to excuse them in those circumstances. And so even the pagans have the law. So we're without excuse, no matter if you know the law or you don't know the law. You have creation and you've got your conscience. And I think that's what we would say, is that we know that these things are true because we have the whole creation, which doesn't make sense. There's no reason for beauty, right? It has no evolutionary meaning, but we're surrounded by it.
And it's one of the names of God.
And we swim in it. And the second is that we have a conscience. That no matter what we tell people, they know somewhere in them, unless they've killed their conscience, that there is right and there is wrong. And they know when they've done wrong. So we've got these two things that speak to God, that speak to His creation of us, that speak to His existence and His continual upholding of creation. So again, we're without excuse, as is everybody without excuse. Now, we might have blinders on. We might be blinded because of the ideas or depraved wisdom that we're surrounded by. It's true that we can't properly understand the full significance of what we read because of the darkness induced by the passions, and our presumption often leads us astray, especially when we rely on the wisdom of this world. That's a quote from the Field. Yeah, from the Desert Fathers in the Field. So I would agree to that 100%. So in other words, what do we have that really leads us in the right direction to the point where, you know, that we know? And again, we have lots of evidences of this. You know, lives of the saints, people that have died and come back. We have all kinds of evidences. People that have seen angels, people that have seen demons. I mean, we know this is true. And, you know, can it all be measured scientifically? Who knows? But we know it's true. And where do we know it's true? In the laboratory that counts, which is in our hearts. And so we say, taste and see. Try it out. And that's what we always say in the Orthodox Church. And if you have total freedom, you make your decision. But that's how we learn. And sometimes we have to get a head bash or two before we wake up. But that's how it works for yourself.
Thank you.
Thank you, Father.